Welcome to Great Australian Lives.
For Tobin Brothers Funerals,
celebrating lives. Here's your host, Laura Turner.
Hello and welcome to another special edition of Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is one of Australia's most successful and celebrated fashion and interior designers whose unique sense of style has had a significant influence on our wardrobes and homes for more than two decades. She was the first Australian to mount a full-scale ready-to-wear collection in Paris in 1995. She won Australian Designer of the Year in 96 and the Louis Vuitton Business Award in 1997. In 2017, she was awarded an Order of Australia and was inducted into the Design Institute of Australia Hall of Fame. It is my pleasure to welcome Colette Dinnigan to Great Australian Lives. How are you, Colette?
I'm good, and thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure and an honour. We're excited about tonight's show. You've had such an illustrious career, which I'm sure would have had its moments during the pandemic when everyone was wearing tracksuit pants and UGG boots. I mean, how does fashion thrive and survive when all people want to do is lay on the couch, or all they can do is lay on the couch?
You know, I think it's like even when the Lehman Brothers and everything went crashing down in New York and parties stopped, some businesses thrive and others kind of go down under a bit. But I think everything changed for us, not just what we wore. It's about what our priorities were, and cooking became more important, comfort, closeness, you know, close proximity to the family, that was good or bad for some. But I think generally it was really about reassessing our lives, and was a big sort of break for everyone to kind of take stock. And, you know, I think fashion, regardless of how much we still love to fantasize and look good, and that it was really about being comfortable and practical. And I think, you know, money wasn't easy to come by for some. So the priority really is about getting good food and paying the rent and keeping the family together and healthy.
Do you think it's had a long-term impact, I mean, on fashion? I mean, for so long, people weren't buying corporate wear because they, you know, they weren't going to the office, or party wear because they weren't allowed to go to parties. Though the brands that service those parts of fashion obviously would have been really affected. Well, do you think that'll have a long-term impact on the way we dress and buy?
Well, I get asked all the time, and I still think it's important to dress appropriately. And if you're going for a job interview, and if it's in a legal firm, you know, don't turn up in your tracksuit. You know, kind of make an effort and feel the part, because I think, you know, even for myself, when I'm going to anywhere that has that kind of sense of authority or that attention to detail, you want to see that people are wearing smart attire or at least a uniform. Kind of gives you a bit more reassurance, I think. But I do think people take to fashion perhaps, but I honestly believe that any time when there's something really bad and sinister, or something in the world, you know, world history has gone dark and grey like the World War, suddenly there's a breath of fresh air and colour speaks, and there's song and dance and celebration. So I imagine we're going to see a lot of great, fantastical, fun things in fashion, and people will forget very quickly that they're comfy, was in their tracksuits on the couch, because they'll want to change. And I think that's what we thrive for sometimes. A lot of people don't like change, but I think positive change is, you know, always something that's uplifting.
I spent the pandemic praying that we wouldn't see the high-heeled UGG boot. The hybrid from comfort and fashion evolve from the fact everyone's wearing their slippers. Did you have to change the focus of your work over the past 18 months? You know, how did it impact you personally and your brands?
Well, because we've been living in Italy for the last few years, and I've been doing a lot of interiors. We have our Casa Olivetta in Puglia, which, you know, this is our second big lockdown. We were in Italy in lockdown for 7-8 months. So we spent a lot of time on our property there, which was extraordinary because we got to actually live in it in the olive fields, and wasn't a holiday home, and we planted vegetable gardens, and everything became about cooking and family. And then, you know, with that time, I met some amazing potters. So I just developed a ceramic collection, and that was fantastic as well. And I've actually just brought that to Australia. And I also started developing fragrances for candles. So I'm about to launch those. So a lot of my go-tos, instead of textiles, I ended up doing, you know, a lot of fragrances and scents and cooking and gardening. So it was very much about the home.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, COVID refocused a lot of people, and it sounds like it's done it for the better in many cases, and you too, in sort of finding a new creative path, which is now doing well.
Yeah, no, definitely. But, you know, at the same time, it's quite difficult not having the team to help. It was sort of, I was doing everything, and I still am, and it's, you know, I'm not that IT savvy, so spreadsheets and costings and things aren't my forte. I'm very good at drawing a bit of a logo or sticking a sticker on a candle jar or knowing exactly the proportion and the colour it should be, but, when it comes to the IT spreadsheets, not so good.
Yeah, you can't expect to have both sides of the brain. I certainly don't. Spreadsheets just look like another language to me. We'll talk more about your incredible career and, of course, your recent foray into television as one of the contestants on Celebrity MasterChef. First of all, you know, it's almost Christmas, so what is really relevant right now, you know, we're all looking for Christmas gifts for our children. I know I certainly am. And one of my kids said to me the other day, you know, Christmas is when the snow comes and when we see the snowflakes. And I got so disappointed and thought, no, it's not. That's not where we live. You've been watching too much TV. And that leads me to the book that you, your second children's picture book, Santa Loves Australia. And he has an incredible journey through some of our beautiful, iconic places, doesn't he?
I wrote that book when we were in our quarantine on our way back from Italy last year. We had our son who had his eighth birthday in quarantine. And, you know, we were just talking about things and making up stories. And I thought, and he said, oh, gosh, so we don't get to have snow in Australia for Christmas. You know, he either misses the Italian summer and we come back home for Australian winter. And I said, no, but you know what? Santa loves to come to Australia because it's so cold up in the Northern Hemisphere and it's his favourite place and he gets to see all the beaches and see all the animals. And it was so inspiring because it's sort of, you know, writing the book for me, it was about even teaching parents about parts of Australia that we don't know about and the different Aboriginal names for the animals and the places and what each state, I think, has as its kind of identifiable animal, or the cheeky cockatoos, or with the lizards, like, you know, the pelicans, and even with the flying doctors. And it was a really great journey for myself and my son. So I just thought, you know, it's a great idea to do it as a Christmas book rather than having it just as a story, because it's really Santa's take on Australia and his loving to come south for the warm air, and it's his favourite stop.
You'd have to get air conditioning in the sleigh.
Oh, he probably rides fast enough that it's all self-air-conditioned.
What makes a fashion designer turn their hand to writing children's books, though? You know, I mean, you're obviously very creative. Did it just pop into your head one day to start doing this?
Well, I got asked to write a couple of years ago a book, it was Louis and Sippy Saves the Sea. I mean, I guess I've always been very conscious of the environment and very sustainable right from the get-go, and worked with factories that don't sort of put their chemicals into the oceans or the rivers. So been very mindful of it. And when I started that book, I was in Italy actually, 2016-ish, I think. I was so appalled to see how much plastic there was in the oceans and in the Mediterranean and on the sides of the streets. And I felt like Italy was a third world country. And I realized how much Australia and New Zealand have going for them when you see so little plastic and pollution. But still, you know, to me, it was, you know, the idea of plastic drink bottles. We don't need them anymore. There's so many ways to recycle, and I think the world's changed very quickly since I wrote that book. And it was just about having our next generation, which is our children, aware of what they need to do, because I think it's so hard to change some adults' perception or habits or the mentality too, that we have to buy spring water from a plastic bottle. It has to go, because we can actually filter it and make it perfectly drinkable from the tap. And children are doing that already, you know, whereas adults aren't. And it was just a fun book to write, because it was really, I spent a lot of time on the ocean as a child, because my parents, we sailed from South Africa to Australia and then New Zealand. So, you know, I really did see the whales and the seals, and I did see what plastic could do to some birds. And I think it needs to be informative but fun and a good story. And it was also for adults too, really, in a way.
It sounds like a beautiful concept, and as you say, it's exactly what we need. Santa Loves Australia is, I guess, a little bit more to do with fantasy. Sorry, children who might be listening. But your writing is so beautiful in that one as well, and evocative. And Luke's illustrations too are absolutely just beautiful. I mean, obviously, I'm imagining you would write it first and he would illustrate later. Could you explain the process to us?
Oh, yes. A couple of bottles of wine, a nice meal, lots of paper at the dinner table. And, you know, it has to be fun, right? So, yes, I would write it, but then we would kind of just talk it through in the illustrations. And we really did do it through dinner, and we had a very big, you know, A5, great artist block, and we were drawing both of us together, and it got wilder and wilder. That's what it's meant to be. It's meant to be fun and fantasy. It's not meant to be. And, you know, I mean, Santa's sleigh, I know you're saying it needs air conditioning, but as far as we're concerned, it's totally off the grid. You know, it's like no power, lots of reindeers, feet in the wind, but it's fun. And I think everything in life, you've got to have fun. Nothing's easy. So you've got to have fun, and it's got to, when you're having fun, it seems effortless, but it's nothing is. As you know, but I think it shows in the book. There's a lot of fun, and it's kind of it's magical, and it's interesting, and it's informative as well as being kind of cheeky. You know, the cockatoos and all the different things, Luna Park. There's a lot of cheekiness there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And kids need fun to be interested anyway. Mm. So you've ticked every box, that's for sure. So you've struck it lucky with Luke. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, and Tobin Brothers offer a range of very practical solutions to help you plan a funeral and pay tribute to your loved one. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au. Our guest tonight is designer, author, and current celebrity MasterChef contestant Colette Dinnigan. In a moment, we'll find out where Colette's passion for fashion and design all started.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. I'm Laura Turner. Our guest tonight is one of Australia's most successful fashion designers, Colette Dinnigan, who has also turned her hand to writing for children. Her new picture book, Santa Loves Australia, is in stores now. And what a time for it to be in stores, because, of course, we're all out looking for presents and able to go in store, which is just wonderful. Now, Colette, you mentioned in the first segment that your family sailed from South Africa to New Zealand. I want to go back to your time in South Africa. You were born there, obviously, including a younger brother too, and then lived on a yacht. What a life before becoming who you are.
No, it was amazing. I mean, I can remember being in Africa quite clearly. And my mother, she was a great artist and a great cook and just a great homemaker, actually. And I can remember one time, we'd go into the bush because we lived in a place in Mandini called Mandini in Zululand. And she often would find old houses and she'd take the balustrades and make bed heads. And one time we went, and I can remember there was a big lion just lying on the balcony. And she was like, oh, I said, Mum. And she said, he'll be fine. He's just wanting to rest. He's obviously had a big, that's for a big feed. That's why she said, that's why I always take a broom. You just sweep them away. And I can remember, you know, just having moments like that. And of course, he just gently went away and she just shooed him and he was like quite annoyed. He had to move. But there's just things like that, I think, in life that as a child I'll never forget. And, you know, just even being on the yacht as well. I mean, there was a time, I mean, we saw incredible whales and so many different things. One time my father, because we didn't have any navigation equipment, we just had the sextant and charts, and so there was no contact with anyone. It was back in the 70s, and wow. We were sailing quite far south, and he was like, oh my goodness, what's that up ahead? And there were all these birds and seagulls, and was a raucous. He's like, oh my god, maybe there's been a volcano recently and there's an island that's just happened to pop up in the middle of the ocean. And he was petrified, because if that was the case, the charts were all wrong and you could hit a rock or And I can remember just the whole, that stress in the family, like we didn't know. And as we got closer and closer, we realized it was a massive dead whale, sperm whale that was bloated, and all the birds were eating it, and the water was lapping up against it and it looked like a small island. But and then another time, wow. It was just, there was There were so many different things. So another time I can remember, we went swimming and we were really far south and the water was freezing, my brother and myself. And when you're on a yacht, people think you just dive off and jump up onto it. But when you're actually sailing, there's no stairs. It's not set up for, it's a sailing yacht, not set up for swimming. And so we had our harnesses on and Dad was dragging us around the boat and it was really, really cold. And he thought it would be fine because we were so far south, there'd be no sharks. And then as children do, my brother and I started fighting in the water. He pulled my brother out. And then as he pulled me out, I could see his face. I could never forget the expression on his face because a big, huge white pointer came up with its jaw straight up. And my legs were being pulled up. And I can remember getting to the top of the deck and seeing it. And it was, my dad was a very smart man, but he didn't realize that they went south to feed or breed or one of those things, one of the two.
Oh, my God.
And so the waters filled with sharks. And, of course, us being, you know, like penguins in the water fighting, it probably attracted them. But there were so many different things. And I think, you know, living on the yacht, you just learn to be really independent and you learn to respect nature and you've got to obey the rules. You know, it's such a small space. There's no room for being disobedient and you can't just jump off because the currents are too strong and there's so much that happens, yeah. Even though you think it's quite boring. It's a lot happens every day. It's a different day every day.
I'm so jealous, Colette Dennigan. Can you please make your next children's book about the family who lives on the yacht and all of those adventures? That would be incredible. And the illustrations. I mean, you could have the big jaws with you being pulled out of the water.
I know. Another time, I mean, there's so many stories, and some of them are very sad. Another time I can remember when because we ate a lot of fish, and so we would throw lures out the back and we'd catch a lot of tuna. And, you know, there's only so much tuna you can eat, but anyway, I'm surprised I still like it. And one time we caught this huge albatross and its wingspan was wider than the yacht. And it was just so, you know, it was quite dangerous because when you get them on board, you know, their wings are so strong. And but Dad managed to calm it down and take the lure out of its mouth. And often you'd see them, but this time we didn't. So we would always take the lures out if we could see that they were there, because it's nothing worse than, you know, such a beautiful bird, yeah, having a big hook in its mouth and either having to cut it. But this time I can remember he managed to get it out.
Oh, good. Please, can you write that book? I just think that would be incredible. I've always, you know, my children live a pretty boring Australian life on land, and I constantly think I would love to take them out to see the whales and dolphins on one of the boats, but you lived that. That is just incredible. What sort of a child were you? Were you drawn towards fashion from those early days, or did it take a while to develop? It sounds like you had a creative family.
My mother did a lot. When we got to New Zealand, she ended up working with a fabric company and doing a lot of textile design and helped, you know, she would do the sales in the fabric shop and do a lot of batik and, you know, remember this is the 70s and those wraparound skirts and things.
Oh, 70s fashion is my favourite.
Great colour and prints. And so I would often get the remnants and all the old sort of large buttrick patterns and things, and I'd cut them down and I would make clothes for myself. Or, you know, it was never, I want to be a fashion designer. It was like, well, we weren't, I guess I just made them because my mother bought me a sewing machine and I had access, yeah, to great fabrics and samples and leftovers and whatever, offcuts. And so I started that way. And I really wanted to be a marine biologist, actually, because I guess my life on the sea made me want to change a lot of things and or do veterinary science. And, you know, when I was going through school, I just was so impatient. And I think that's one thing that has happened, because living in Africa, hardly going to school there, spending a couple of years on a yacht, not going to school, then, you know, I wasn't somebody that was used to the system, I guess. And yeah, the idea of 7 years at university to do veterinary science wasn't where I wanted to be. So I just quickly changed. Yeah. My arts teacher said to me, and my maths teacher, they said, go on, do graphic design or fashion. The course closes in a week. I'm sure you'd be great at it. And it's only 3 years. And I was like, oh, yes, fantastic. I'll go and do that. I'll get out of New Zealand.
Did you like New Zealand? I used to live in New Zealand. Did you like it?
Oh, you know what? I think in those early days, back in the 70s and the 80s, it was as my mother said, oh my God, they don't even know what real coffee is here, and they haven't heard of Tabasco sauce, and everything was instant coffee and Nescafe and no chilies and no fresh salad. But I think since then it's changed considerably, and it's one of my favorite countries in the world. The wine, the food, the people, the landscape, the beaches. Yeah. Oh my God! Yeah, even the architecture. You know, I love the architecture, the old and the new architecture of New Zealand. And I think it's a very undiscovered country in a way. Yet it's got a very big voice, and it's got a great prime minister. There's so much to be said for the country.
You were embracing fashion, so you would have come out of your course and sort of cutting your teeth in the fashion world in the 80s and 90s. Those eras are now considered retro by the young people, you know, wearing and buying up fashion today. Do you have favourite fashion styles from the 80s?
Well, I guess the shoulder pad wasn't my favourite.
I love a shoulder pad.
Square one.
Oh, you don't like
it? But
them.
I love a small, rounded one. I know, stop here, shut. It comes straight back. But I do think, you know, back then it was, I don't know, what was it? I can't remember. I guess because that's where I started, you tend to forget about it. But there were a lot of little hop pants and a lot of frills. Yeah. And that's when I started my late. I mean, I first started working in film and television when I first came from New Zealand. And then I set up my own label. And a lot of that's when I first started, where it was all that lingerie, outerwear look and little slip dresses and layers and lace and corsets and hop pants. And so it really wasn't the Kylie Minogue era of, you know, spinning around.
No.
It was fun.
Yeah, it's a different look. Yeah. That must have been a challenging time setting up your own label and getting noticed.
It must have been the early 90s. I'm not good with dates, but there was, you know, the government had changed all the tax breaks for the film industry, and there wasn't a lot of work in the film industry then. So I started making clothes and people in the magazine business that I have a few friends that I had. And remember, there's no phones, there's no kind of the whole PR thing happening so much in Australia. So I was literally making clothes for friends at Mode magazine, which isn't around, Clio. And then I started making lingerie, finding old laces, putting them together with silks. And I started getting orders. And then I thought, oh, I might do a catalogue. And I can remember it going into the Sydney Morning Herald on the back page. Susan Owens used to do a back page. And she showed pictures of it, did a shoot, and it said, if you want a catalogue, put a self-addressed, you know, stamped envelope into to this address. I got thousands of these self-addressed stamped envelopes. There was no capturing databases or emails or anything. And so I had to print these catalogs and send them out. And then people would send them back with money and orders. And I would spend all night in the studio that I shared with the graphic artist while he was printing and doing huge kind of screen prints. I'm there sewing lingerie and hem rolling and hand sewing on.
Wow.
And that's how it started, really.
They are some sore fingers hand sewing on bows and things for such intricate pieces. That's incredible.
I think when you're young and what you don't know is that you just have to keep on going. As you get older, you're kind of like, okay, how much work is this going to be? Is it worth it? And I think it takes away a bit of that curiosity. And I think, you know, I was very driven. And to be honest, even now, I'm still, you know, I'm a hard worker, but as long as it's something I'm not bored with, I've got to be motivated.
Absolutely. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Colette Dinigan, who is the first Australian fashion designer to mount a full-scale ready-to-wear collection in Paris in 1995. And we'll head to Paris with Colette and find out about that defining moment in her life in just a moment. Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Australian fashion and interior designer, writer and wonderful cook, as we're learning, at Colette Dinigan. Now, Colette, you, as I've said, really made your mark in Paris in 1995, became the first Australian to launch a ready-to-wear collection. First of all, can you explain for listeners who don't, you know, have their head around fashion in such detail, what ready-to-wear actually means?
Well, I guess in particular, I mean, I still think Paris is top of the game. You know, if you're showing in Paris, it's where it's at, because a lot of the designers that have come out of Paris is, you know, there's Louis Vuitton, the LVMH group, the Chanel, Christian Dior, anybody or any company that's the best of their game, they show in Paris. And there's two calendars. There's the men's, but if you just look at the women's calendars, there's the couture, which is January and I think maybe July. And those couture collections are for the very top clientele who will see the most incredible clothes, and they'll often be between $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, extraordinary amounts of money, but handmade. And they'll almost have the, you know, the princesses and the of the world and royalty and big, huge stars and very wealthy customers who will get made to order pieces. Whereas ready to wear, the collections that that are shown in March and September usually, and they're for designers like myself, Louis Vuitton still, who don't do couture, say Balenciaga, there's so many of them, Zimiaki, Comme des Garçons, and they will show collections that will then end up in a shop that a customer can go into the store and buy. And after they've shown the collection to the press and to retailers, retailers will place an order and each of the shops will have the collection. So it's at a much lower price point, but there's a lot more clothes. Ideally, it's about presenting a designer's vision for the next season. So when I would show, it'd still be my signature collections, but with a twist. So it might be, you know, about butterflies, or it might be about, you know, all about, say, Uluru, or something will inspire me and that collection will take that direction. Or it might be everything short, everything long. It's where I felt creative in that season to go. And some were winners and some were big time flops.
Must be disappointing when there's something that you really love that doesn't fly well when you get to such a big world stage.
Oh my goodness. You know, the things you love the most are the ones that people don't buy. So I've learned when my, you know, just even my store managers, and they love something, I'm like, really? You're going to sell that? Why not this? And so I'd have to go with them. And every now and then I kind of invested in something that everybody disagreed in, and it would go because it was so different. And but sometimes it's about the balance, you know. It's not really about just everything commercial. It's about, you've got to tell a story, and to tell a story you can't just have the middle ground. You've got to have the top and the bottom. You've got to start somewhere and you've got to finish somewhere. So I believe in that and everything, and there's always something that's got to be a focal piece, and it might not be the piece you wear, but you get to understand the rest of it when you see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that the preparation to tell that story in Paris, where there is such global attention and the biggest brands, as you've listed, I mean, that must be a stressful process. How long is your planning to get to that show finally in Paris?
Each collection, I start on the next collection before I've even shown the collection that I'd be showing in Paris. So it's at least 8 months in the making. And what's really difficult, when you, apart from the logistics of transporting everything from Australia, is that in Europe they work on the summer, you know, they're in the season, the Northern Hemisphere. So as a result, you know, for us, we have Christmas holidays and everyone closes for 4 weeks, whereas in Europe, they close for 2 to 3 days and everyone works through. So my collection, which is winter, is so difficult because I'm trying to get everybody through summer not to have a holiday and take their holidays in August, which is winter. And it was always so difficult to try and work that out. And it's difficult because I guess the rest of the industry doesn't work that way here unless you're working on a Northern Hemisphere season. So, but it is difficult, and, you know, and also being, but it is, on the other hand too, I think I always saw it as Australia being my backyard, and having something remote enough that you're not so influenced by what everybody else is influenced by. So you kind of have to really give it a go with, you know, creatively and push it in another direction. It can work sometimes and other times perhaps not.
This might be a really silly question, but I always notice there's a common thread through some of the shows. So it seems like, you know, many of them have picked up on a certain feel for the year ahead. How does does that happen? I mean, you might see in the magazines or whatever, you know, flares are the big thing next season, or floral prints or whatever. How does that common thread emerge if you're all competing against each other?
That's something I also ask, because it's like, how did I make everything yellow and then so did Louis Vuitton and so did Chanel? Yeah. And I'm like, how did that happen? And I don't know. It's not because we all have the same fabric suppliers, we don't use the same dye houses. But what I think it is, it's about what I was talking about before. When we've kind of gone through a period, you know, where it's been very grey and dark, I think people come out with bursts of colour. And when it's been very hot and very arid and very dry, the last thing you want to do is kind of present a collection that's all orange and yellow. You kind of tend to go a lot more somber and dark. And so I think it's our internal reaction as creatives and artists to what's happening either politically or climate-wise, or, you know, and I just think it's a subconscious. That's what I think. This is my theory. I could be completely wrong. So, but yeah. It does intrigue me, because it is most definitely, you know, that does happen. However, I know when I started, I can remember it was the time where the Belgian designers all had their heyday, you know, Andy Mulemeester, and there was that very androgynous, masculine kind of edge to fashion. And I guess perhaps why I got attention was because I was much more about lace and femininity and prettiness and prints and colour, when that really wasn't on the cards. And I think sometimes to stand out, you've got to take the risk and make the change.
Good contrast. Now, I want to talk about your first store. Another huge step, a risk, of course, but a very proud moment for you too. Do you have, you know, some memorable moments for that era in your career?
So when I opened in Paddington, I mean, goodness, it was, yeah, it was, but it was one of those things, you know, I lived above the shop, I cooked out the back, I had a studio up the road, I was kind of jack of all trades, and it became, you know, a very small place to live, but I was really there the whole time. I didn't have to travel a lot. I was kind of shop bound. But it was great because I connected with my customers, and it wasn't in a obvious location, so I was really destination, and it grew slowly, which was good because it wasn't, you know, too rapid where I couldn't manage everything. And in fact, it was because of my customers that I added, you know, jackets and pants and dresses to the collection that was predominantly sort of lingerie as outerwear. So it was really driven by my customers and buyers.
You were just going from strength to strength in that era through the 2000s. Do you have moments from that time? I mean, Marks and Spencer had you had your collection in there, and you were showing all around the world. Do you have memories that are your favourites?
Yeah, when I got asked to do actually the collection for Marks and Spencer's, it was a lingerie collection. That was quite an honour, because I mean, M&S back then especially were so known for their underwear and their cashmeres and t-shirts, their basics. So, you know, I created a new label called Wild Hearts, and I got a great photographers, Ellen von Umworth and Helena Christensen, to do the modelling of the lingerie. So it was a huge change for Marks and Spencer's as well. You know, it was very feminine and sexy and good quality and at an affordable price. And I think that was the kind of change that started happening in the world. This was one of the first collaborations that any of those lower end or, you know, more franchise stores had worked with a designer. And I think since then you've seen H&M and other stores do it. But I still have the mentality that good design and good quality doesn't have to be in polyesters and bad colours to make it cheap, you know, and affordable. Good design can be in good colours and, you know, the right prints and everything at the same price. So it was my ethos about showing us just much more the scale of economy, and it just means it's not as, you know, limited in its quantities. It's about good design's important on all levels, and, you know, we need to... I guess a lot of stores use that as an example, and it did very well. So that was, you know, that was really a highlight of my career, actually. And then working with other people, like being asked with Specsavers even to do a collection, because I wasn't known for eyewear, and yet, you know, it was a whole another learning curve for me, because I had to learn about optical and sunglasses and design. But I really enjoyed it, because I think it's the people you work with and the teams and the production quality that they have is what's so important, because you don't need to work with another designer. You need to work with a good production company that's you know, has good quality. But also, you know, it's quite lonely working on my own. So these collaborations were a breath of fresh air because suddenly there was people and ideas to bounce off, and I had statistics or this and that, and I had a lot of people bringing things to me rather than me always being my own kind of research. And so, and I, yeah, showing in Paris, definitely a highlight, opening my store in London as well. And even being asked by Barney's in New York, who's no longer there, to do my first trunk show. And they were so excited. They printed these posters in their windows and gave me all their windows in 7th Avenue and 7th, I think, oh no, their new store. And they put, the posters were like, let's put another prawn on the Barbie, Colette Dunigan's coming to town. And I was like so embarrassed, thinking, oh my God, how could they think Australians are about beer and Barbies, you know? But everyone turned, they all turned up.
This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. And our guest tonight is Colette Dunigan, designer and writer and one of the stars of Celebrity MasterChef. We'll find out about Colette's love of food and cooking in just a moment.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
What I've learned about myself is that now it's given me the confidence to kind of take on other chefs' recipes and push myself to a place where possibly I just used to go to my repertoire. I'm kind of a lot more confident to go further afield.
Welcome back to Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Our guest tonight is Colette Dunigan, one of Australia's most successful and celebrated fashion designers, who's also impressed us with her cooking abilities as one of the contestants on Celebrity MasterChef. We, of course, just heard a little bit of the show just now. Now, Colette, MasterChef has just wrapped up. We won't give away any spoilers, as I'm sure a lot of people are recording and binge watching later. So we'll keep that secret safe. But we talked earlier in the show about your love of growing food, especially in Italy. How do you end up on Celebrity MasterChef, though? That's another high-pressure environment for you.
Yeah, I asked myself the same question. Well, I first of all said no the first three times. Great producer convinced me, said I'd have so much fun and, you know, learn so much. And I was like, yeah, right, okay, yes, you're very convincing, obviously, extremely, because there I was. I sort of thought about it. I thought, here we are. I've just been through 8 months in lockdown in Italy. I've had to move back to Australia. Our lives have changed so dramatically. What have I got to lose? And, you know, I'm in my 50s now, and I was thinking, you know, what else am I going to really challenge myself with? We tend to kind of retreat, well, I do anyway, and I've kind of found my comfort zone. I found even in Italy, I would only go 3 minutes to my favorite coffee shop. I knew where I shopped every day, and I had my three or four favorite restaurants. And I felt like, you know, I get back to Australia, I've got my favorite coffee shop, my same favorite restaurants. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take myself outside this block, and I'm going to see the worst thing that could happen is that I'm first to go out. That's the worst thing that can happen, but I'm going to try.
Did you surprise yourself? You're up against the likes of Gordon Ramsay's daughter and Nick Riewoldt even. I mean, their personalities on the show too, that they really shone.
Oh, absolutely. Tilly's a delight, and she is so mature and worldly and obviously lives in a cooking kitchen. So she's been around it all her life. And Nick is, you know, a true gentleman. He's elegant, he's gentle,
player.
And he's kind of the quiet achiever, really, in a way, but stands his ground and strong. But I think for me, it wasn't really about going on thinking I was an amazing chef. It was about just going on and doing what I could do. And I hadn't actually ever watched MasterChef before, so I was quite surprised to find out about these challenges, because I really did think we'd go on and cook our favourite things but maybe had a time limit. So, you know, right. The second week when elimination started to happen, I was quite, you know, it was a real, I had to take stock really and sort of start to think, gosh, I better learn how to make an anglaise, and I better learn how to do this, and in case I'm thrown at it, because it was nerve-wracking and long days, and it was a big pressure. But I think it's like everything in life, you know, if you work under pressure, sometimes you make the right decisions. And in fashion, like in Paris, there are many shows, you know, where things went wrong and backstage, and the whole idea is to kind of just make a decision. To not make a decision is the worst thing, and you lose time. And
yes,
I just did my best, really.
And those of you who are listening to Colette Dinigan tonight, of course, her beautiful new children's picture book, Santa Loves Australia, is it ready for Christmas and in stores now. I can't wait to get my hands on it for my children. And, of course, Colette Dinigan's experiences are all on her website, colettedinigan.com, and you can catch up on her wonderful time in Celebrity MasterChef via 10play.com. Colette Dinigan, thank you so much for being with us. It's been such an honour to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed our chat with Colette Dinigan tonight and you'd like to share it with a friend, subscribe to the Great Australian Lives podcast. And of course, join me the same time next week when we celebrate another great Australian life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to Great Australian Lives with Laura Turner for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.